Scripture reading this evening is taken from 2 Samuel, chapter 7, verse 12. That's 2 Samuel, chapter 7, verse 12. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom.
At the end of 1 Samuel, Saul and three of his sons were killed in battle. At the opening of the book of 2 Samuel, David does not yet know about that. There's an Amalekite young man, at least he says he's an Amalekite, who desperately wants to get that news to David. He's anxious to tell him, and he's anxious to gain a little credit for himself. So when he tells David what happened, he embellishes a little bit. He lies. He tells David that Saul was injured, and that therefore the Amalekite, thrust him through so that he would die. And he figured he'd get some credit because David had been on the run from Saul, and Saul and David had been enemies in Saul's mind. But you remember, David was one who would not lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. And so David rebuked this Amalekite for raising his hand against the Lord's anointed. How was it you were not afraid to raise your hand against the Lord's anointed? And therefore, he said that the Amalekite should be struck down and executed because of killing the king. And he was. David didn't take kindly to this sort of thing, as we find out throughout the book. The rest of 2 Samuel is a history of David's kingdom fraught with violence, wars, raids, battles, conspiracies, rivalries, all through his kingdom. In chapter 2, there is the anointing of David in Hebron, the city, where he would reign for 7.5 years. The rest of his time, he'd reign in Jerusalem for 33 years. There's also, in 2 Samuel chapter 2, the establishment of a man named Ishbosheth. Now, in some translations, it's Eshbaal. He and Mephibosheth have similar names in that the second part of their name has something to do with the idol Baal, B-A-A-L, or Baal, as some of the Hebrew scholars would pronounce it. And we don't know why exactly that is. Some have speculated that Ishbosheth was sort of an illegitimate child of David, but I don't know how you figure that when David had so many wives, of Saul, in the same situation. But Ishbosheth was announced to be king of Israel by Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army. So when Saul dies, Abner, the commander of his army, thinks Saul's family ought to have rule of the kingdom of Israel. There's one son left, apparently, whose name is Ishbosheth, and he sets him up to be king. Well, that's only going to last for a couple of years before he would be killed. Abner then has his army against David's army at the pool of Gibeon. Abner's the commander of Saul's, or Ishbosheth's army, and Joab is the commander of David's army. And one of them Abner suggests, let's just let the young men perform for us. They feel like it's going to be a show. And in that day and era, in a show, somebody might just get killed. Let the men fight. Let them fight to the death. Well, that's what they did. It turned out to be not much of a show. There were basically about two moves to it. Each of the young men grabbed his opponent by the head, and each of the young men thrust his opponent through with the sword, so that 24 men died all at once. Then a great battle ensued, and Abner started to run. Now, David had some nephews. His sister was named Zeruiah, we find out in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, and she had three sons, Joab, the commander of David's army, Abishai, and Asahel, A-S-A-H-E-L. Now, Asahel, it says, was fleet of foot. He was very fast. Well, Abner is on the run after this battle, and Asahel just keeps running after him. And apparently they're close enough that they're able to have some sort of conversation, and Abner says, stop chasing me. Why should I bring my wrath on you? But Asahel won't turn back from chasing him, and he's on his foot, he's on his tail. So Abner takes the blunt end of a spear and rams it through Asahel. It must have been going at a pretty good speed, on foot even, for that sort of thing to take place. Rams him through and kills him there. Then Ishbosheth, in the next chapter, insults Abner. Chapter 3, verse 1 opens with this marker passage, if you will. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. That might be a theme verse to 2 Samuel, because the rest of it is war between these houses. Now, the next thing that happens in chapter 3 is that Abner makes an accusation, Abner makes an accusation against, Ishbosheth makes an accusation against Abner. Ishbosheth says that there was a concubine of his father's and that Abner had gone into him. And Abner, I don't know if he really didn't or not, but he strongly denies it. And he says, are you going to insult me like this? Am I a dog's head that belongs to you, that belongs to Judah? You're going to insult me like this? So Abner is going to switch sides and try to get everybody on David's side. But Joab doesn't like that all too well because Joab feels threatened by it. So he takes Abner to the side and thrusts him through with the sword, and Abner is done. David then mourns for Abner the way he mourned for the sons of Saul and for Saul himself. He mourns for him in song. And then in chapter 4, Rechab and Baana, the sons of Abirathite, came onto the scene, and their motive is to make sure that David secures the kingdom. They take it upon themselves to murder Ishbosheth and bring the head to David. So that threat against David is done. And we meet somebody else in this chapter. In chapter 4, verse 4, we meet a son of Jonathan. Remember Jonathan, whom David loved? Jonathan has a son named Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth can't walk. He's lame in both his feet, we find out, because he was 5 years old when all that furor took place at the death of Saul, Jonathan, Malchishua, and Abinadab. And his nurse picked him up. Mephibosheth's nurse picked him up to run, but she fell somewhere along the way and injured him in such a way that he never would be able to walk. We're introduced to him in chapter 4, and he comes up again later. David then reigns over all Israel, chapter 5 tells us. He reigns for 40 years, the first seven and a half in Hebron, and the other 33 in Jerusalem. The rest of chapter 5 tells us how he got Jerusalem. The Jebusites had lived there, and they were a little arrogant about their position in the city. They challenged David's men. They said, essentially, even if we were all blind and lame, you couldn't overcome us. Well, they did overcome them, and David then ruled from Jerusalem. Hiram, the king of Tyre, who becomes prominent later in Solomon's history, offers to build David a great house. Tyre at that time had the cedars of Lebanon, the greatest trees in the world at that time. And Hiram's great bargaining chip with everybody else, I mean, things haven't changed much. There are bargaining chips on the table all the time. There are tariffs, that sort of things, gifts back and forth, trade between countries. Well, Hiram's big bargaining chip was those cedar trees, and sometimes he would use them as gifts. Recognizing officially David as the king of Israel, Hiram sends cedars to build David a house. David then has another battle with the Philistines. And then we come to monumental chapter 6. The Ark of the Covenant has been in Abinadab's house in Kirjath-Jearim for 20 years, 1 Samuel 7 says. And now David is finally going to move it to Jerusalem. He's got a home. He's got a place. We have a place for God's house. We're going to move the Ark of God. It doesn't go well. They take the Ark of God from Abinadab's house. They set it on carts. That was mistake number one. The Ark of the Covenant, as well as the other furniture of the tabernacle, was to be carried by poles. There were rings that were made for the four corners of it. You're supposed to put two poles through it. And then Levites only are supposed to carry it. Well, these fellows weren't Levites, and they put it on a cart, so that was a mistake to start with. Nevertheless, there was all kinds of celebration. David had all kinds of musical instruments playing. There was all kinds of celebration. But the ark tumbled a little bit. The oxen stumbled, and he thought Uzzah and Ahio were the ones carrying it. And Uzzah thought, you know, this thing's going to fall over. I'm going to help God out by holding this Ark of the Covenant up. And he touched it, and when he touched it, he died. Which has forever been a lesson to us, that things that might seem right to us aren't right. Levites weren't even supposed to touch the ark. They were supposed to carry it with those poles. And then this fellow got too close, and he thought God needed some help, and it didn't work out well for him. This made David angry, so much so that David called it Uzzah anger, or Perez Uzzah, the anger of, towards Uzzah, called that place Perez Uzzah from that day forward. Finally, then, they take the Ark of the Covenant to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, someone from the city of Gath and the Philistines, a foreigner. But the Lord blesses the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, because the Ark of the Covenant was there. It's there for 3 months. When David finds out, he goes and gets it and brings it up to the city of Jerusalem. And then he rejoices. He's wearing a linen ephod, and only a linen ephod, apparently not dressed very appropriately. He's dancing before the king with all of his heart. And then Michal, his wife, M-I-C-H-A-L, his wife comes and sees him doing that, and she despises him. She hates him for it. She rebukes him for it, and he rebukes her in return, and then the Bible gets the final rebuke on her when it says, therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. She shouldn't have rebuked David in that incident, I guess. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, David expresses his desire that he have a house. You know, I've got this great house that Hiram, king of Tyre, built for me, and the Ark of the Covenant doesn't have a place to live except a tent. It's in a tabernacle. Why should I not build a house for God? Seems like a reasonable thing. The prophet Gad thought, that's a reasonable thing, go do that. But then that night, the Lord spoke to Gad and said, tell David not to do that. We don't get all the reasons right here in 2 Samuel chapter 7. We do in 1 Chronicles 22, we get another reason that's a very important reason. David had shed too much blood to build the house of God. David was a mighty warrior. David slew people by the thousands. Did you read through 2 Samuel? There were 20,000 that died here. There were 23,000 that died there. He had too much blood on his hands and able to build the house of God. But God says, here's what I do for you. You'll die, you'll rest with your fathers, your son will build my house. Now at the end of David's life, he makes some preparations so that Solomon can build the house of God, and he would build the house of God. But then God makes the significant promise to David, here starting in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that the throne of Israel would never depart from his household. That's still true to this day. When Israel stopped having a king, its last king was from David's household, an earthly king, that is. His name was Jeconiah. When Israel started having a king again, it was spiritual Israel, the church, and the king was Jesus Christ. Gabriel said to Mary, the angel Gabriel said to Mary in Luke chapter 1, you're going to have a child, and he's going to reign over the house of David, and of his kingdom there will be no end. So this is a messianic promise here in 2 Samuel chapter 7. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, the violence continues. David attacks the Philistines and subdued them. David took Metheg-Ammah from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab. And then in a passage that just befuddles me, he takes two lines, he uses to measure off those who were to be put to death, and one line he uses to measure off those who would be kept alive. I don't know if they did anything to deserve these deaths. I don't know if he just randomly chose them. But that made the people see that David was in charge, and from that time for a while forward, he ruled well in Moab. Now let me pause and correct something that I said last week. Last week, when I was talking about the Ark of the Covenant in 1 Samuel, I said we got to Samuel 7 and Kirjath-Jearim, and we didn't hear of the Ark of God again for a long time. I forget exactly how I said it, but I feel like maybe I erred. Because we do hear of it again back here in 2 Samuel chapter 6. I apologize for that error. That's at least one that I caught. In 2 Samuel chapter 9, David wants to be kind to somebody in Saul's household. He's fought all these wars. He's trying to secure his kingdom from Saul's people. But he says, is there anybody left of Saul's lineage to whom I could show kindness? Well, this is an interesting plot twist that comes up here. Ziba, Z-I-B-A, has been a servant of King Saul before Saul died. Ziba is asked by David, is there anybody from David's household to whom I could show kindness? David says, yes, Mephibosheth, the boy who was 5 years old when Saul died, he's lame in his feet, you can show kindness to Mephibosheth. So David says, good, bring him here. He brings him and he pronounces all kinds of blessings upon him. He says, Mephibosheth, you're always going to eat at the king's table. You're always going to have provisions. You're always going to have something to eat. And the estate of Saul goes to you. the house of Saul, the land goes to you, Mephibosheth, and Ziba, the one who told me about you, Ziba and his family will always be your servants. They'll always be your slaves. So Ziba says he seems like he's good with that. He makes some nice remarks about it. He says in chapter 9, verse 11, according to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so your servant will do. That sounds good. Let's leave it there for now. In chapter 10, there are some other scores to be settled. David wants to be kind to Hanun, the son of Nahash, the Ammonite, because of some kind of kindness that Nahash had shown David at some point. We don't know what that was. You remember back in 1 Samuel, Nahash was not a really nice guy. He came to the city of Jabesh-Gilead, and he said, I'm going to take over your city by war, or you can surrender, but if you surrender, I'm still going to put every one of your eyes out. Well, he ended up being defeated. So Nahash wasn't a real good guy. But at some point, he'd done some kindness to David, and David wants to thank him for it. So he sends some representatives to the city where Hanun, his son, is reigning. But Hanun despises the servants of David and treats them mockingly. He shaves off half of their beards. Well, first of all, that looks dumb in about any society, doesn't it? But it was especially remarkable for a Jew to go out in public like that. Matter of fact, after that happened, David told them to stay hidden until their beards had regrown. And the second thing he did was he cut off their garments at their waist so that they had nothing from their waist down to wear. He shows them shame. Well, David is going to exact some vengeance for that, of course. And then we come to 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12, which about everybody knows from childhood. It's the sordid affair, literally, of David with Bathsheba. David's on the roof. He should have been at war. Kings went to war at that time, and he should have been there. He wasn't. He was at home in leisure, and he saw Bathsheba bathing, and he called her to him. He's the king. He can do what he wants. Did you ever think that maybe the worst thing that happened to David was that he became king? He was a man after God's own heart. We'll talk more about that later. And then getting all this power helped him make some mistakes along the way. I've heard of people. There was an actress back in the early 20th century who was supposed to be one of the most beautiful women in the world. Her name was Hedy Lamarr. I haven't seen too much about her, but I've read a little bit. She was a brilliant woman. She helped invent Wi-Fi the way we know it today. But she said late in her life, she was regarded as one of the most beautiful women. They used to line up guys for World War II for fundraisers, pay a dollar to kiss her, pay a dollar to kiss her, that sort of thing. And she wrote at the end of her life, I curse my face. I had a beautiful face, and I curse it. It caused me nothing but trouble. You ever wonder if the worst thing that ever happened to David is they became king? He's at home when he shouldn't have been home. And he sees Bathsheba, and he has the power to bring her. He doesn't have to ask. He's the king. He can do what he wants. She's married to Uriah the Hittite, somebody of a foreign land, but he impregnates her, and then when he finds that out, he tries to cover it up. He calls Uriah from the battle. Uriah fights right by Joab. Uriah is fighting for David, even though he's not of Israel. Uriah is a noble man. David calls Uriah and says, why don't you take a break, go down to your house tonight? He figures he'll be with his wife, and that'll cover up the pregnancy. Everybody will think it is Uriah's child. But Uriah goes down, sleeps on his porch or somewhere like that because he's a noble man. And then David asks him why, and he says, well, all my buddies are at war, and I'm not going to go and have pleasure while my buddies are at war. So David tries getting him drunk, and that doesn't work either. And finally, David sends a note with Uriah to Joab. Don't read this note, Uriah. To Joab. When Joab opens up the note, it says, put Uriah in the hottest spot of the battle and then draw back from him quickly so that he dies in battle. Make it look like an accident. Make it look like an act of war. So that's what they do. David murders Uriah. There's collateral damage. Several other soldiers die in the same thing. And David thinks that the matter is done. Until Nathan the prophet comes to him with a parable. This man had many, many sheep. Another man had one little ewe lamb that he loved like a daughter. The man that had many, many sheep had someone come knock on his door and ask for some food. And the man that had many, many sheep wouldn't take one of his many sheep that he'd never miss to prepare for this man, but he stole that one ewe lamb from that poor fellow and cooked it for that stranger that was passing through. Well, David's angry. Who is this man? This man needs to be punished. And Nathan said, famously, you are the man. Because you had all these wives, you have all this going for you, and Uriah loved his one wife, Bathsheba, and you took her, and you killed him. And because of that, Uriah says, there are going to be consequences. David's going to be forgiven, but as I hope we learn, there is forgiveness, but then there can still be consequences to sin. And there will be consequences. One of those consequences that Nathan the prophet announces is that David's concubines or wives would be had by somebody else in the sight of all Israel. That would happen a little bit later in the book. Another consequence is that that child that Bathsheba was carrying would die because it would bring too much shame to the household of David. And you think that's not fair. Well, the child would go straight to be with God, not have to deal with all these wars and everything, for one thing. David mourns and weeps and prays and fasts for that child. The child is sick, but the child dies. And when the child dies, David poignantly gets up, cleans himself off. Everybody thinks he's going to harm himself. But he says, no, I can't do anything. The child's dead now. I shall go to him, but he can't come back to me. David looked forward to seeing him in the afterlife. It's one of those passages that reminds us that we'll know each other in the afterlife. Well, the wars then continue. Rabbah of Ammon is captured. And then the immorality continues in chapter 13. Amnon is a son of David by one woman. Absalom is a son of David by another woman. Tamar is a daughter of David, I think by the same woman that had Absalom. So Absalom and Tamar, if I'm remembering correctly, would be full brother and sister, and Amnon and Tamar would be half brother and sister. But Amnon, pervertedly, was in love with his sister. He was in lust with his sister and looked after her. And he had a crafty friend that said, here's what you do. You tell the king you're not feeling well, and tell the king it'd make you feel really good if his sister cooked something and brought it to him. And then when she's here, you take advantage of her. That's what he did. And he was stronger than she was, so he forced her. When Absalom found out about that, he waited and held his peace for 2 years. And then at some particular feast where he had begged the king to send Amnon and send the other sons, and finally they'd gone back and forth, and finally David sent them, and Absalom told his servants, when I give the signal at the feast, everybody rise up and kill Amnon. And they did. And then Absalom ran away because he knew his father wouldn't like that too well. Joab had some sympathy for Absalom, though. So Joab puts up a woman to go and dress up in front of David and pretend that she has a story to tell in chapter 14. This woman of Tekoa comes in essentially to plead Abner's case, but she does it in a roundabout way, much like Nathan did back in chapter 12. She says, I need some judgment from the king. I have two sons. One killed the other, and now they want to take away my only other son, and then I won't have any estate left to me. And David says, don't worry. I'll protect your other son. She says, can I say a little bit more? Because you lost one son, Amnon, by your other son, Absalom, and now everybody, including you, wants to get Absalom. Why don't you let Absalom come home? Well, it touches David's heart to a degree, and he lets Absalom come home, but doesn't let him come near him. Doesn't see him for a couple more years, if I remember the chronology correctly, until finally Joab wants attention. Absalom wants attention, and he goes through Joab. Well, that's what happens. Absalom wants attention, and he goes through Joab. Absalom sends to Joab, but Joab won't answer. It's a lot like texting people, some people, that never answer you for 5 or 6 days. It gets kind of blustering sometime. Well, here's what Absalom did about it, something I don't recommend. Absalom said to his servants, go set Joab's fields on fire. Well, that got Joab's attention, and he came to Absalom and said, why are you setting my fields on fire? Well, you wouldn't answer my text. Well, no, it wasn't quite that. But he got Joab's attention, and Absalom said, go to the king for me. So Joab went to the king, and Absalom finally then got back to the king himself, and David kissed Absalom, and they had a great family reunion. You'd think Absalom might be thankful for that forgiveness, but he wasn't. He treasonously stayed outside the king's house. And when people would come to the king, he would schmooze them with the language of a politician and tell them, well, if I were in power, things would be different. There's nobody to hear your case, but if I were in power, your case is right and you'd get some justice. And by this way, he won the hearts of the people of Israel. And there are several hundred people with him. He starts to make a rebellion, so much so that David and his men have to escape from Jerusalem. Now, can't you just see what's happening when this is happening? The officials of David's household are having to decide, am I going to go with Absalom? Am I going to stay with David? Am I going to go with David? Am I going to stay with Absalom? What am I going to do? And so there's some shakeup in that regard that you have to read about for these few chapters. David has to flee. Some of the priests try to bring the Ark of the Covenant to the Jordan while the people are fleeing. They do that. But then David says, don't bring the Ark of the Covenant with us. Take it back because maybe the Lord will be kind to me and allow me to come back to this city at some point. So there's a man named Ahithophel. He's like chief of staff or something for David, an advisor. And everybody treated his advice as if it were the counsel of God. Ahithophel goes over to Absalom's side. When David hears that, he says, God, please let the counsel of Ahithophel be turned into foolishness. Amasa was the commander of the army of Ishbosheth and then Saul and Absalom at that time. And when Joab finds out that Amasa is the commander of Absalom's army, Joab takes him aside and kills him too. He's always out for some vengeance. Now when that happens, some people are desperate to go and tell David, but they get slowed down a little bit because they're not so sure about how David will react. Well, Absalom finally then goes to war against the house of David, and Absalom is defeated. I've skipped over some things. Ahithophel gives some advice. It's not taken, so he goes home and kills himself. Hushai the Archite has stayed behind as a spy. He gives some advice, and then he sends people to warn David, and those people have to hide for a little bit themselves, and then David and his camp get out of town while Absalom's coming. But then there's finally this battle where Absalom is riding along, and David has said to his men, whatever you do, be kind to the young man Absalom. Be gentle with the young man Absalom. Well, they don't. Joab doesn't. Absalom, according to the King James, he gets his hair caught in a tree. According to other translations, he gets his head caught in a tree. As he's riding along, the horse just keeps going out from under him. He gets his head caught and he's hanging there in a tree. And Joab says to a man who's beside him, you just saw him hanging there and you didn't take his life? And the man said, well, no, David said not to take his life. Joab said, well, look, watch this. And Joab thrusts him through, and along with 10 men, they come and make sure that he's dead. And when David hears of that, he cries, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, O Absalom, my son, my son. In chapter 19, David returns to Jerusalem. People have cursed David on his way out of town. Shimei had cursed David on his way out of town. Now on his way back in, he's begging and he's schmoozing up to David. And David has a heart of forgiveness. Until he's on his deathbed in 1 Kings, and then he says that you ought not let this person live. David finally meets Mephibosheth. Now what happened in the meantime that I skipped is that Ziba had come to David when David was running from Jerusalem. Ziba, that servant, had come to David with all kinds of gifts, and he says, why are you doing this? Well, I just want to help my king out. Well, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba lies. Ziba says, Mephibosheth is staying back to be a part of Absalom's kingdom. David said, okay, Ziba, you can have all of Saul's household now. So first he gave it to Mephibosheth. Ziba gets it for himself. Now David finally has a chance to meet Mephibosheth. And he says to Mephibosheth, he finds out that Mephibosheth had been lied about. This man slandered me. So David's frustrated with it. He doesn't know who to believe, maybe. Maybe I'm getting it wrong too. These are just what they say. And he says, well, you and Ziba just divide the land. But then I think we know who to believe when Mephibosheth says, I don't care about the land. Let him take the land. I've been blessed plenty enough. Man lame in his feet, gets to sit at the king's table, been through this war, been lied about, has this great magnanimous attitude. If you want to look for a hero in the story, look at Mephibosheth. Under behind, under the radar, behind the curtains, being generous, being a servant. Then, in chapter 20, the rebellions aren't done. Sheba starts a rebellion, and the people have to chase Sheba out of town. And the people come to a place where Sheba has run into a town where this wise woman steps forward and says, "Why are you guys trying to overtake our town?" They say, "We're not trying to overtake your town. We just want Sheba." She says, "Just wait a minute." And then she and some other people get together and they take off his head and throw it out to assuage the people who are coming after David. I know I got a couple of things out of order, and I'm sorry about that. I hope you can sort it out. It's all kind of baffling to try and get in order. Then David finds out about the Gibeonites. Remember these Gibeonites? They had been the first ones that had been left alive in the land of Israel because Joshua didn't ask counsel of God and they pretended to be from far away. But the Gibeonites at some point did something that was kind, and David wants to reward them David wants to pay them back for some injustice that had been done them. So they say, "Well, we don't want money. What we want is men. We want Saul's lineage." So David gives them 7 sons of Saul to kill as their vengeance. And the mother of 2 of them stays with the bodies and fights off the carrion birds until David finally comes and collects their bones and puts them with Saul's and Jonathan's and gives them all a decent burial. Interestingly, in chapter 21, Goliath comes up again. One of his sons is killed. Another of his sons has 6 fingers on each hand and 6 fingers on each toes, and he is killed. A brother of Goliath is killed. And then David writes the song that we see in chapter 22, where he says, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my strength in whom I will trust. I shall call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, so shall I be saved from my enemies." He wrote that in the day that he was saved from all his enemies. 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 1, calls David the sweet psalmist of Israel. And I like to get this across to young boys who are afraid to pipe up and sing sometimes because they think singing might not be a manly thing to do. David had too much blood on his hands to build the temple, and he was a harpist and a singer, and the best one that Israel ever had. David said some last words about ruling in justice and ruling in the fear of God that would be good for any ruler to take to heart. But then David messed up again. In chapter 24, he decided to number Israel, and apparently that didn't put faith in God, put faith in his numbers. God allowed it to happen, but then sent a message that there was going to be some punishment and gave him a choice. 7 years of famine, 3 months of being chased by your enemies, or 3 days of the plague from the Lord. David said, "Don't let me fall into the hands of my enemies. Let the Lord deal with me." Though that's either number 1 or 3, and God chose 3. Gave him 3 days, 70,000 people were killed. David, in the meantime, has to go and try to offer sacrifices to get it stopped. He goes to the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. And Araunah says, "I'll give you anything. I'll give you all the animals you need, anything you need to make these sacrifices, I'll give it to you." And David makes this profound statement: "Nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing." I'm not going to pretend to serve God when I don't have to sacrifice to serve God. So David built an altar there, and the plague was withdrawn from Israel. Now David, Acts 13:22, says, was a man after God's own heart. And we always wonder how that could be. Well, there are some godly characteristics that he had. He didn't want to raise his hand against the Lord's anointed. He was very forgiving when somebody that rose up against him, was treasonous against him, would die. David would mourn that person, would not rejoice over it. David was sad to see people die. David didn't want to have enemies. He killed a lot, though. He committed fornication, adultery, murder, had several wives. How's he a man after God's own heart? I'll never solve it. I want to suggest one thing to you that has come to mind. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14, when Saul first sins, And Samuel tells him, the kingdom is being taken from you. He puts that line in there. And Samuel doesn't know who he's talking about yet. Samuel doesn't know that he's picking David yet. But he says, the kingdom is being taken away from you, Saul, and the Lord is seeking someone after his own heart to serve in this role. Well, David comes along. Nothing else is said about him being after God's own heart until in Acts 13, well, maybe in Acts 7 with Stephen, but especially in Acts 13 with Paul. Paul is preaching through the history of Israel, and he refers to David as that man that God chose after Saul, the man after God's own heart. So I think it's one thing to think about that perhaps, just perhaps, David was a young man after God's own heart. Power corrupted him. Maybe the best thing that would have happened to him would have been not to be king. But David would then always come back around to the right. He made mistakes. He made grievous errors. He did things that were horribly wrong. But he would always come back around and seek mercy from God and yet pay the consequences. Now he is in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ would come from the kingly line of David. And when Jesus Christ died on the cross, you might expect then that David's heart for God would have satisfied God enough that the mercy of Christ's blood would roll backward and cover David's sins. And here we are today, hoping that we are touching people's hearts, that people might be after God's own heart. And I stand up here every week, and I realize that I'm not perfect. And you realize, I know, humbly, that you're not perfect, and that we all come back to God for mercy. We learn from David that whatever we do, we keep coming back. God promises to keep showing mercy. If you've not been baptized into Christ, we hope you would be tonight. If you've been unfaithful to Him, we hope you'd come back with repentance and prayer. If we could help you, would you please come as we stand and sing?
From the ages,